This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Recording this show at the very end of 2024. So it seems appropriate to look back and ask, what have we learned? Luckily, Bassem Haddad has been doing this for a while. Bassem is an associate professor at George Mason University, where he is also the founding director of their Middle East and Islamic Studies program. He has been producing a kind of podcast on YouTube this year, and it's a series of one-on-one conversations with various MENA experts. The series is called What Have We Learned? For What Have We Learned, the guest gets to name five themes or topics they want to talk about in relation to what they have learned about them recently. The show is then a discussion of these topics between the guest and Bassem. What Have We Learned is produced for Jadaleya. I've shared their work on the show before, and I'm excited to do it again. Jadaleya is relatively new on the scene, but I love what they do. As a media company, Jadaleya operates as a unique source of reporting and critical analysis of the Middle East that combines scholarship, advocacy, and local knowledge. Bassem's show fits that description perfectly. He has done 15 episodes of What Have We Learned, featuring a variety of guests with a variety of types of expertise. The episode of Bassem's show I want to share on this show was the last one of 2024, and it was with Susan Abdulhawa. I feel like Susan needs no introduction. I kind of feel silly doing an introduction for her. She is an award-winning Palestinian novelist, essayist, and all-around writer and orator. She recently went viral with her statement at the Oxford Labor Union debate supporting the motion, "This House Believes That Israel is an Apartheid State Responsible for Genocide," and she has been all over the media since then. But I suspect her conversation with Bassem went more under the radar than her other appearances. And that's a shame because it's a really insightful conversation. It's also a more freewheeling conversation than other media settings provide for. It's rare the guest gets to fully choose the topics of conversation. And Susan chooses to talk about some very interesting things in even more interesting ways. I'm not sure what you would expect Susan to have learned from 2023 to 2024, but she brings deeply felt and deeply known insights about the nature and actions of colonialist oppressors versus their colonized and oppressed. She also broadens the concepts of resistance and coexistence in ways I had literally never thought about. Trust me, it's not what you think, but it's absolutely brilliant. So what has Susan learned over these past 14 months of genocide? You'll have to listen to find out. So yalla bina, let's go.
Good afternoon, Suzanne. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, how are you?
It's great to speak with you. I am very much looking forward to our conversation. This is What Have We Learned? It's the 15th edition, and you have selected a number of very interesting topics, titles, themes. First, Israeli society. Second, language and representation, and more. Third is resistance. Fourth, Arab states, which I'm glad you selected. Not a lot of people selected Arab states because it's probably a foregone conclusion, but there's also an important need to talk about the Arab states or the absence of. And then coexistence. So we are going to get right to it. But first, before everything, with this, Alec, I want to ask you, Inti Kifik, how are you doing and how are you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think none of us really know how to answer that question anymore. And
yeah,
a friend of mine told me a while ago, she's genocide functional. So I'm going to repeat her words, genocide functional.
Wow, that's actually better than the answer I was giving for a long time, which I actually also stole from a friend. And that answer is whatever. Genocide functional is more apt. Yeah. All right. So we usually start with a question that you can answer at a personal level or at a at an analytical level, and that is, can you tell us where are we in this moment right now? Anything about this moment that we're in right now that you want to start with before we get to the five topics? We'd love to hear from you where you think we're in this moment. You can emphasize anything you like.
Well, I think we could use the whole show just to talk about that question, Bassam. I think, you know, in some ways we are, even though what's happening in Syria right now seems to have taken people by surprise, it should just be no surprise. We are along the continuum of the plan that Empire has laid out and has explicitly laid out, and which we have failed to meet with sufficient resistance. The resistance that we have been able to put up merely has delayed their ambitions, and we allowed them to regroup. That said, I am not pessimistic by any means. I remain optimistic despite and probably touch on this during the questions and my answers to your questions, but I remain optimistic about the future. I'll say that.
I respect that, and I actually appreciate it. And no, I also am accused sometimes of, you know, why am I not pessimistic? And on the one hand, we have to keep surviving. On the other hand, we have to keep fighting, struggling to confront the beast, all the beasts, not just the big ones, by the way. So the first topic that we're discussing today is very complex, and I'm very happy that we have you here to address it. I've heard you speak on this topic before, and it's a delight to hear you address it, and that is Israeli society. And the question is basically is, what have we learned in the past year of Israel's genocide about Israeli society?
I think the most striking thing that I've learned about Israeli society is truly the depths of their depravity as a people. I think even those of us who are familiar with the extent of their racism and their sense of supremacy, because we've been the victims of it, it has still been shocking to watch the sheer mockery, sadism, and joy that they exhibit and feel when they execute and cheer on this Holocaust against Palestinians and against other Arab countries like Lebanon and now Syria. I think like every colonial supremacist society has had such elements of this kind of moral perversion. And sometimes it's even widespread. But I think what we're witnessing from Israeli society is unprecedented. For example, if we just like look at American society, white supremacist Southerners who took pleasure and pride in lynching Black people, they even exchanged photos of lynchings as holiday greeting cards. Like what we're seeing is kind of on par with that. But even in that society, this kind of pathological, violent disposition, it didn't represent the majority of the nation. And we know that because of, for example, the shockwaves that rippled across the country when Mrs. Till decided to have an open casket for her son Emmett's funeral, so the world could see what those monsters did to her son. And so the revulsion around the country at the sight of his body and the photos in the newspapers was really palpable. And some would say that that marked a pivotal moment in American history when it comes to kind of racialized socio-political matters. But in the case of what's apparent for Israeli society, what they see on a daily basis kind of makes the torment and disfigurement of Emmett Till seem like child's play. Like the whole world is watching this daily mutilation and dismemberment and beheading and shredding and suffocating alive and burying alive of Palestinian men, women, and children. And their reaction to this carnage has been this inhuman, incomprehensible sadism. They seem to love it. They set these pictures and videos of such inhumanity to music, and they post it with pride. And so I think that the world has never seen anything like this kind of wholesale sadism, where everyone from politicians and journalists and influencers to academics and physicians and soccer moms, all making these kinds of genocidal statements about killing, about raping and burning and bombing whole societies, like they're discussing the weather or discussing sports teams. And even like the fact that there were protests throughout the country against holding gang rapists accountable, you know, insisting from the top to the bottom of their society that they have a right and even a duty to rape Palestinians. I mean, and it's beyond pathological, and it should really terrify the whole world that there is a society, there is an entire society like that in the world. And, you know, to be fair, there are elements within Israeli society that do seem to have a conscience and a moral compass, but they are such a minority as to be negligible. And this is apparent in all the surveys and polls conducted in Israel.
Suzanne, if somebody hears you from within Israeli society who thinks of themselves as a humanitarian, but they belong to that category that are supporting the genocide, that are watching those videos. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody agrees with everything that they are watching, but most people are watching and most people are continuing to support what they're watching, statistically based on Israeli polls. But if somebody basically told you that they don't accept what you said about the lynching analogy in the United States with African Americans, because they feel that there is some sort of justification or response or so on. First of all, why do you think some people will disagree with this characterization? Is it because they see Palestinians on a spectrum of humanity that is like inhuman, or is it something else? Is it revenge? Is it sort of a trauma? What could it be that would cause somebody to disagree with your portrayal? And what would you say in response? I know this is a double hypothetical, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that those white Southerners would say that they were justified too, that they were doing this as a response, that they felt like their way of life was threatened, that these people had it coming, that, I mean, they all had justifications. Nobody thinks of themselves as evil. And of course, they're always going to be defensive about it. You know, white settlers had felt like they were justified and good in decimating the entire indigenous American society. They felt like it was legitimate to give them blankets laced with smallpox. So what they think is of no concern to me. What people who are cheering and conducting a genocide think and claim is of no concern to me, and it should be of no concern to anybody, frankly. They should not matter. What they say doesn't matter ultimately. These crimes are beyond horrendous. They are beyond war crimes. What we're watching day in and day out is inflicting trauma on everybody just by watching, and imagine what it's like to live through that. So I don't accept that, you know, they disagree or agree. I don't frankly care. They don't matter to me. They are nothing to me.
And that would apply also to people who, for instance, cheer atrocities based on or coming from the other side. In other words, when people actually visibly on camera were cheering the 9/11 attacks, because most of the dead were civilians, at least, you know, this is what we have been able to confirm. Does it also apply to those people, and how do they justify their cheering? I mean, the scale is completely different, absolutely, but I'm talking as a matter of principle. People who cheer things like that, they say they're justified. Is all these justifications on all sides of the spectrum vis-a-vis similar events something that we should not care about, how they justify it?
So what you're justifying atrocities against children, against families, is never acceptable. And frankly, I don't know who was cheering other than the five cheering Israelis at 9/11. I mean, those were the ones cheering.
Including those, yes.
They were dancing and cheering. And Netanyahu said, this is good for America. I mean, this is good for Israel. So those were the people who were cheering. It wasn't us. They tried to say that it was us, but it wasn't us. As a matter of fact, people in Gaza and the West Bank lined up to give blood because ultimately, no matter how much you hate somebody, no matter how much you think they have wronged you, normal people cannot but recoil from the images that we're seeing, no matter who it's happening to. As much as I find Israeli society utterly reprehensible, there is nothing in me as a woman, as a mother, as a human being who could ever rejoice in watching their children get shredded or buried alive. So I don't think it works yeah. The other, as a matter, and also I would say that there is also a difference. There's a difference in power. When people who have so much power, who rain constant violence and death on another people, when they are harmed, it's a very different matter for their victims to cheer, to have a bit of Schadenfreude, than for them to react with supremacist sadism. There's a very big difference because the power gradient runs one way. Does that make sense?
Yes. I wanted us to get into that because there will be, it's important to establish, not necessarily just distinctions, but to establish a principle. And what you said about being a mother and a woman, just a human being, that you cannot, you know, bear the reverse either. And, you know, there's no justification for it. That's where we need to be. And, right, in terms of the principle. And when I said, I mean, there were like images on 9/11 or even on October 7th vis-a-vis certain sorts of victims, right? I mean, when fighters are killing each other is one thing, but then when we see what we are seeing, for instance, in Gaza, day in and day out for now 14 months, obviously it's something else. But the principle is what matters, and what you said, for as far as I'm concerned, is what's important. That I cannot bear also seeing even a political opponent or a member of frankly a racist cult have their children be mutilated in that way.
And honestly, Bassam, I want to say this. I have no doubt that despite everything that's happened to people in Gaza, if the roles suddenly were reversed and the kind of carnage that they are enduring were suddenly they were seeing these images in Israeli society, I don't think they would accept it. I really don't. I find that their humanity is intact. Even Hamas, which the media loves to paint as these absolute monsters, if you look at the massive disparity in the way that they have treated Israeli prisoners versus the way that Palestinian prisoners have been treated by Israelis, you know, there's no moral equivalence. I mean, Palestinians are getting raped and murdered and tortured. Israeli prisoners come out talking like with fondness about the people who kept them. They can't, I mean, there are stories of, you know, one guy getting a cake for his birthday baked by people who are literally starving. So I think there's a big moral disparity. And this is often the case, actually, and it's not just us. This is often the case, this moral disparity between victims and victimizers. I mean, historically, colonizers and oppressors are always afraid of the agency and the freedom of the people they oppress because they think they're going to turn around once they get power and do the same to them. And we saw this with slavery and with civil rights. White people were scared of Black people because after raining terror on them for a few hundred years, they feared that they would turn around and do the same to them. But it's the moral equivalency is quite, I mean, there's no moral equivalency, rather. The moral disparity is the rule rather than the exception. And we see that in nearly every instance. We saw this in apartheid South Africa. The white minority was scared that the Black native majority was going to do to them as was done unto them. But that was not the case. What we find historically is that the yearning for liberation and to live dignified lives eclipses the sense of revenge or the need for it. That has been historically the reality of colonized and oppressed people.
Yes, and this is what I think is some of so many of the people that have been opining on this issue keep addressing and repeating. There's the question of just sheer violence, repression, mutilation, and genocide. But then when it's laced with notions of supremacy, it is almost automatically justifiable, which is precisely why the world is actually quiet when it is happening to brown people for the most part, as opposed to when the reverse happens, you know, all hell is raised. And people don't realize this. So I feel that we do need to bring these examples up, because in the real world, quote unquote, especially in the United States, the irony is that supporters of Israel's state, a racist apartheid state, almost by definition now, according to most independent, if not all independent organizations, they think that there's no more equivalency in the reverse sense, which is a very interesting acrobatic, moral, and analytical move. But yes, I know this is difficult, but I just wanted us to go there.
Yeah, yeah. And I should add another thing about like what I have observed or learned more deeply about Israeli society is that I think I never really appreciated the extent to which these messianic ambitions really pervade all layers of Israeli society in one way or another. There really seems to be a core belief that being a Jew is a higher form of human, that it comes with inherent entitlements to earth and resources that are not and should not be accorded to or should not be the purview of the rest of humanity. And you hear this kind of rhetoric in come out sort of Afawiyan, sorry, I'm like drawing a blank for in English, in interviews, and it comes across in, you know, in documentaries and just questioning random people in Israel about the future, about what it means to be a Jew, what it means to be a non-Jew, etc. So I think decades of sort of instilling this kind of supremacist education from a young age is what has led to this deeply pathological society.
Absolutely. We saw it in all episodes of extermination of the other, mm-hmm. including of the Jews in Germany and beyond. Now, let's move to the next topic, which is very exciting. I mean, I don't know how exciting any of this is, but it's very interesting. Language and representation, and your selection included or encompassed media, Western values, free speech, and so on. So this is quite loaded.
Yeah, it's more to me like on the assumptions inherent in words and in language. So like, of course, you and I and everybody in our movement sort of understands the ways that corporate or Zionist media utilizes this kind of abusive language to distort and manipulate public imagination. So like we see it every day in Western headlines where they use the passive voice and to treat really what's an intentional genocide as if it were like a natural disaster that just befell Gaza, as if bombs are just falling from the sky of their own accord. And we see in the past few days, the media has been using words like rolling into, entering, crossing, to describe what is in actuality a violent and expansionist Israeli invasion to steal land and wealth from other nations. So I think these sanitized words are used because they carry assumptions. All words have history and legacies that evoke intellectual and emotional responses in all of us, depending on our lived experiences. And so, for example, Israel is, as I'm sure you know, partnering with this Zionist American corporation to build what they're cynically referring to as gated communities for what little remains of Palestinian society in northern Gaza, which they're frankly stealing in broad daylight. And so the term gated community in Western imagination invokes images of beautiful homes and green lawns, safe neighborhoods, good schools, etc. But in reality, what they're referring to with gated communities is tantamount to ghettos, to prisons, and concentration camps. It's kind of like calling Auschwitz a gated community. So like a lot of the general public is often fooled by this kind of perversion of language that serves genocidal colonialism. But the layers of society that constitute intellectuals, activists, revolutionaries are not necessarily fooled by them. And thankfully, I feel like these layers are expanding, especially with young people. But there's still, I find, some misleading ahistoric terms that still pervade public and even intellectual and revolutionary discourse that lead to logical fallacies and conclusions. For example, I recently was made privy to proofs of a book by an activist that I admire, somebody who's quite brilliant. And as I was reading, I saw there were references to what they described as, quote, the Jewish people. And I think that this term is one of the more insidious perversions of language to convey a concept that actually has no basis in history, in reality, or in forensic evidence. This idea of like a singular racial or ethno-religious group called the Jewish people never existed at any point in recorded history prior to Zionism, much less a group having exclusively and collectively been at any one point in one place. And it's one of the more insidious and successful Zionist fairy tales that have been sold to the world and upon which so much else is predicated. So, you know, for example, like since the dawn of Judaism, there have always been Iraqi Jews who were separate and distinct from Yemeni Jews, who were separate and distinct from Persian Jews, from Palestinian Jews, Syrian, Egyptian, German, Polish, Russian, Ethiopian, etc. There has never been a cohesive cultural, ethnic, or racial group called the Jewish people. No European Jew ever looked upon a Yemeni Jew and thought, that is my brethren or my sistren prior to Zionism. I don't even think they still do. It was exactly the opposite, in fact. European Jews held the same racist views against brown people, Jewish or otherwise, that were pervasive among their non-Jewish European compatriots. So there was something like 22 Zionist, it may be even more, World Zionist Congresses prior to the establishment of Israel, where leading Zionists would meet, where they planned and plotted the theft and colonization of Palestine. And not once in any of these like decades of planning was there a single non-European Jew involved in those plans. So non-white Jews were frankly an inconvenient and often contemptible necessity to implement their plans. They needed numbers. So it just kind of underscores this European Jewish supremacist nature of the Zionist enterprise that, and the lie that there was ever such a unified nation called the Jewish people is part of Zionist mythology. And the problem, it's not just this innocent kind of mythology, because so much else gets built on this false assumption. You know, the Jewish people are returning. But if that concept never existed, then the return cannot be real either. Do you know what I mean? It's fairy tale built upon fairy tale. And so I think we have to question all the assumptions we have about language when we look at it, whether it's gated communities, the Jewish people, etc. There's so much in academic literature and discourse that uses and perverts and abuses language to convey like a lie built on seeds of fact, but to completely obscure those facts simultaneously.
Some of the people I spoke with actually addressed what you are saying in terms of European Jewry and their view towards those who are not European or even within Europe, by the way. It's not just, you know, I mean, there is, you know, a certain kind of broad affinity, just like, you know, with Islam today, Muslims in different parts of the world. But I keep saying that Indonesian Muslims have very little in common besides, you know, certain practices with Tunisian or Lebanese Muslims compared to Lebanese Muslims and Lebanese Christians, for instance, and so on and so forth. Is there, just out of curiosity, is there literature on this rift between European Jews and, say, you know, Yemeni Jews and Jews who lived in the Arab world in terms of the Zionist congresses that have taken place before 1948? Is there like a reference that we can add to the post when we put it out?
So I think, I mean, I'm sure there are. So the last I read, I didn't get through it yet, the biography of Chaim Weizmann. So one of the things that struck me was that, you know, it was entire, and I've always known this, of course, but it was entirely European. At no point in any of the discussions or narration of Zionist congresses or did they ever talk about a faction or somebody from the East?
All right. Well, I actually would like
Zionism did not exist in the Arab world. It was not a feature of Arab Jewry. It was entirely European.
No, I understand. I'm just, you know, I think this is a very interesting and important topic. And in the back and forth and discourses about these issues, it's important to sort of, you know, be able to like learn more about this because it's really significant in terms of a certain pretense and what the record says. Okay, this is, you picked like all really involved topics. And this third one is going to be just as involved, which is resistance. What have we learned in the past year of Israel's genocide in Gaza about resistance?
Yeah, so I think that this idea, first of all, that there can be a successful resistance without armed or violent confrontation is another fallacy that has no basis in reality or in history. I also, at the same time, I think that violent or armed resistance is completely insufficient without a multifaceted resistance strategy that encompasses all aspects of society. I think the threat to our existence as indigenous people of the region is exigent, it is urgent, it is profound. And in light of the impotence and the cowardice and the hypocrisy of world leaders and their inability to stop Israel's unceasing barbarism, backed by the United States, I think that we have to find a way to launch a worldwide mass movement. I don't think BDS is enough. I believe that we need to convene a multi-layered resistance movement that's going to employ technology, employ culture, civil disobedience, direct action, lawsuits, and more to face what is truly a threat to humanity and to global order. I think this war machine isn't just destroying us, Palestinians. It's raping our whole planet, and it's subverting all the structures and the instruments that were supposed to keep runaway power in check. We're heading towards a world order that is kind of the jungle, where the powerful just eat and rape and destroy the weaker with no consequence. And that's the future that they're constructing for us now.
And I know, speaking of resistance, just today we've learned that three Jewish professors at NYU were arrested because they were protesting the genocide, which is becoming now the shape of things to come because there are various incidents that preceded it. And yes, in response, so many of us who are, you know, either in academic institutions or even beyond, I mean, it's not going to be enough to quote unquote talk and say, hey, and denounce organization, mobilization, the legal system when it's amenable, because there are times when it is. There were examples in the past couple of months here at George Mason University where judges threw out cases that accused people of being terrorists just because they possessed some collector items. The judge was like, this is bullshit, no. And beyond, and so on. And this is, of course, before next year when the new administration takes hold and it has promised to continue. So the question of resistance, I appreciate what you're saying about how it has to be multifaceted and it has to basically employ and mobilize all our faculties, because what is happening right now let alone the actual coercive settler colonial realities in Palestine. What's happening right now in the United States and many parts of Europe is basically an attempt to create a new norm and to literally, even the ideal of liberalism that is still problematic given the duplicities, even that's being shattered, and it's going to be a new world. So I appreciate you addressing resistance in this multifaceted.
Add to Bassam that I think it has to be, in addition to being transnational, transracial, transethnic, transreligious, I think that one of the important things that we have to accept about resistance, that it has to be multi-generational. And I don't mean just multi-generations within a struggle, that we might not live to see the fruits of our toil. And one of the things that I think colonial or imperial powers work hard to create is this sense of defeat in those people who are in struggle. And they work overtime to imbue these feelings of impotence and helplessness in us that make us just curl up in a corner and accept these unnatural lives of violence and humiliation and deprivation that's heaped on us. And so in that sense, I think to me, one of the pillars of resistance is to resist those feelings. And the way to do that is to kind of accept what the late beloved Sayyid Nasrallah said, Allah yirhamah, that yom inno yom ilhom, yani, that one day is for us, one day is for them. That's the nature of our struggle. And it's important to just accept that, you know, we might not see immediate results. Revolution is never a singular moment of glory. It's a lifetime of, and sometimes many generations of lifetimes of trials and sacrifice and toil and defiance and education and continuity towards liberation. And I think once we understand this and manage these disappointments, like the ones we're experiencing now, you know, it becomes easier to manage. And the last thing I want to say on that is, in resistance, the importance of imagination. So many people, I think, in struggle never really stop to imagine what freedom looks and feels like. And I think if people don't imagine that, they can't reach it. If you cannot imagine a free Palestine, a free Arab world that's open to each other, that's with a unified currency and a unified political agenda, then we can't achieve it. Everything we do has to begin in our imagination. And if we imagine it, it'll be. And so believing that we're going to win is itself an act of resistance, I think.
Absolutely. I actually kept you longer than I thought I would. We still have two topics. So the fourth topic is amazingly important and significant because of its absence, and that is Arab states. What have we learned about Arab states in the past year?
I'm honestly not sure what's more loathsome, the Zionist entity or the Arab states, to be honest. I think more and more they feel and look the same. The positions that have been taken by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt in particular are betrayals of the highest order. I mean, we know that they don't represent the will of their people, but the degree to which they have been able to subdue and trample their own people is beyond tragic. So I think the problem is always at these mediocre autocrats who are put in power by hegemonic Western interests, and they ultimately do their bidding. Frankly, how disgraceful that Jordan shot down Iranian drones and simultaneously allowed Israeli and American jets to use their airspace at will. I mean, it's just shameful. It's shameful that Egypt didn't have enough self-respect to exert their own sovereignty on their own border. And let Israel take over the Philadelphia corridor, despite the fact that it was a violation of the 1978 Camp David Accords. And honestly, what a blight these autocrats are on El Urube, you know. I remember listening to the wonderful former minister, Naledi Pandor. She said, you know, during the anti-apartheid struggle, they could always rely on their neighbors in Botswana and Zambia, Tanzania, Swaziland, and so on. But Palestinians don't even have that minimal support from our neighbors who are in fact conspiring with our oppressors. And frankly, like, the stupidity of these autocrats is off the charts. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more naive, a more mediocre, stupid leadership. I mean, what do they think is going to happen after all the Arab countries around them fall into violent chaos and are being looted left and right by Western corporations and greedy Zionists? I mean, like, does MBS actually think that Jared Kushner is his friend? I mean, does Ben Zayed actually believe that Israelis love and respect him? I mean, they're not only morally vacuous, they are intellectual fruit flies. I mean, these people are steering the fate of the Arab world, are steering it off a cliff. Allah yirhamu Qaddafi warned them all. He said, your turn is coming. He told them after they killed Saddam, and they all laughed at him. You know, to my previous point about resistance and convening a sort of global people's forum, people's movement must necessarily, frankly, involve Arab civil society above all others, I think.
Okay.
Sorry, I hope I'm not going to get you in trouble. I might get myself in trouble with that one, but
no, you can say what people can say whatever they want. I mean, people are being killed and mutilated, and we are supporting them in this country. So if somebody has an opinion that's not popular, tough. Nobody's actually doing anything that is at least exclusionary or racist on these podcasts. So that's that. We have one more very important and sensitive and, you know, perhaps not a hopeful topic, and that is coexistence. I would love to hear your views, and I'm sure a lot of people also would, on what have we learned about the possibilities of coexistence after this genocide?
So I think this is a good heading to follow the previous heading about the assumptions that are inherent in language. Because anybody looking at the word or the term coexistence probably immediately assumes or imagines it's about Palestinians and Israelis learning to live with each other, or other Arab nations learning to, quote, coexist with this malignancy in their midst. But I honestly chose this topic because I see coexistence in an entirely different light. I think, for starters, right now, with everything we've seen, there can be no coexistence with mass murderers and war criminals. That's out of the questions. The perpetrators of this Holocaust of our time have to be held accountable one way or another, no matter how long it takes. Our struggle, as I said, has been and may continue to be multi-generational for a few lifetimes. But the coexistence I want to speak of is more about learning to live with non-human nations. If you start with the tendency of colonizers to refer to native people in zoonic terms, we see that constantly from Zionists calling us animals and human beasts and grasshoppers, snakes, etc. This kind of dominion over all non-human life itself is a function of colonialism. This kind of hostility towards animal nations is not intrinsic to indigenous ways of life. It was imposed on us. In that light, to me, decolonization requires a truly radical reimagining of power and justice and sovereignty. To me, liberation is incomplete if it does not extend to the marginalized and oppressed outside the realm of human society. To truly decolonize, I think we have to recognize the presence and the agency of animal nations. Just as humans have distinct languages and territories and ways of being, so do animals. And these belief systems, this closeness to the natural world, this continuity with the natural world, is an indigenous value that has been completely obliterated by capitalism that has commodified all life forms. I mean, it started with animals, you know, but they move on to humans. You know, I know that a lot of people will hear me and laugh and you know, sort of dismiss it like as unnecessary, and that's not a priority. But I see it completely different. I see this reimagination of power as being an intrinsic component of decolonization, and this kind of solidarity with animals, it involves recognizing their sentience and leaving space for them on this earth to exist. It upends this idea that every inch of this planet is there for the taking, for human consumption, for human exploitation. I mean, these are colonial capitalist ethos that are now just simply taken for granted. And so to me, that's the more important coexistence that I wanted to talk about, because this is something that Indigenous people have long understood about the natural world, about the kinship with non-human life. And these are traditions that reject the separations that Western colonial thought has imposed between humanity and nature and the natural world. So, yeah, and I get it. I know that your listeners will sort of scoff at this idea, but I think maybe generations from now, the truth of what I'm saying will be more apparent. But it is paramount because there's such a disconnect. Even in if you look at like the leading environmental and human rights, animal rights organizations, there's no cross-pollination between them and anti-colonial, anti-Zionist, anti-war movements. And it's really, I think it's a really big rupture that weakens our movements. And the only exception to that has been the youth climate movement that is ostensibly headed by Greta Thunberg, who has been outspoken in her condemnation of Israel and her support for Palestinian liberation. She, wise beyond her years, has made that connection, understands the urgency and the inextricability of the struggle for human liberation with the struggle for environmental protection and wildlife protection. So I think that's the more important notion of coexistence that I would like activists and people in the movement to really think about.
It's very much a struggle for victimized people. Victimized not just, in terms of repression, but also like a full-scale Holocaust to grapple with this. And one can look at history.
It's actually not. If you look at Gaza, there are untold videos and moments of people who have nothing, literally sharing their food with strays. Saeed Al-Ar from Sulala Animal Rescue has been, he's been doing the impossible, trying to treat donkeys and horses who are working to transport people left and right. He's trying to rescue strays. And these are people who are literally being genocided. And one of the things that Saeed Abu Saeed, has talked to me about and has posted publicly is that they're seeing more children embracing and taking in and caring for stray animals. So I think it's exactly the opposite. I think people in Gaza living under this genocide are showing more compassion toward animals and sharing and doing whatever they can when they have nothing.
I'm referring to victims of genocide struggling with the question of coexistence with the perpetrators of genocide, not with animals or other human beings at a time that they are being the victims. Because throughout history, victims of genocide, and unfortunately, we don't know all the stories, but we do know that usually victims of genocide are able to continue living, and the perpetrators of genocide, because they have the power, can absorb their victims from a perspective of subjugation, then continue to absorb their victims from a perspective of subjugation, structural subjugation as a function of their reduced numbers, like, the Native American example and the genocide in the United States. We have a parting question that is not very easy, but it's up to you to decide how you want to answer it. It could be, again, at a personal or an ethical level, and that is, where do you see this going? What's next? But not in the, crystal ball sense. Where do you see us headed within this genocide that we're seeing or beyond, or the human condition, if you will? If you can just reflect on this, that would be great.
So first of all, giving up is not an option. Accepting what's happening, that is not an option at all. And so the question then is, so what do we do? And I really believe that in the absence of a moral leadership and institutional accountability for these horrors, I think we have no choice except to convene and orchestrate a mass global movement of moral society. I think that's really, it's the only way forward. People have to act, and we have to be willing to sacrifice. We have to be willing to accept that there is going to be prices to pay for individuals. And this is something that I'm kind of just putting out to everybody, that we have to start thinking about convening civil society and coming up with a long-term strategy to reverse this march toward utter domination and depletion of humans and planet alike. That's where it's going. I think we have to really think about, in particular, utilizing technology and trying to understand the ways in which we can utilize technology to have an edge. It's not just a matter of protesting in the streets anymore. There has to be a unified people's army, a global movement. Maybe we convene something in South Africa. Maybe it's in Moscow. It has to be in a safe place, but we have to convene. We have to physically be in the same space and start working towards a greater goal that may well take, may well not be achieved in our lifetime. But nonetheless, it has to be put in motion because, frankly, the future that they are constructing for us is terrifying. And they're laying the ground.
Yeah, and we've seen the effect of the utilization of technology to bring down people, groups, parties that have resisted Israel, in the case of Hezbollah in particular.
We can bring them down. Why can't we use technology to bring them down? We have smart people. We have technologically skilled and savvy people. We can employ technology too. And we can and we should.
So it's going to be... It's going to be a very long struggle. The cards are stacked against repressed people, colonized people, subjugated people. But I appreciate your views.
I don't agree that. And I think, yes, there are challenges. But honestly, I think we are exceedingly more powerful than people think. And I just, I think if the billions around the world really...
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. We are, yeah. But it's going to be challenging because the power is structural power besides people power is stacked against the repressed. I mean, that's why by definition they're repressed. That's why by definition Israel is colonizing Palestine and Palestinians, not Palestinians are colonizing Israelis. If that's even a historical, I mean, it's hypothetical, but yeah, what we are witnessing in the region is a reflection of the deck being stacked, especially the past 2 weeks, not in terms of the fall or the collapse of the regime and the walking away of the president without even saying a word to his people, which is it's just unfathomable. But I'm talking about the actual destruction of Syria's military capability by Israel in just 2 days. The cards are stacked against us. We could say otherwise, but the truth is, it's very stark. And there's not one peep, not one word. Today I was, I'll say this and then I'll stop. Today I was listening to Jack Sullivan talking about responding to the question of what Israel did. And he basically endorsed it as a way to avert threat. I mean, going against any notion of all that liberal bullshit that we've been told about international law and sovereignty, just throwing it by the wayside. And of course, if anybody else did it, it'll be a crime against humanity.
Isn't that what Russia said? They invaded Ukraine to avert the threats. I mean, it's the same. That's not okay.
Precisely.
Right?
So yeah. So it looks like we're gonna keep talking about this for quite some time. And I really, really appreciate you responding to our call in a relatively short period. And I hope to continue the conversation. And I hope you all power to you. And I hope to connect and keep connecting. And thank you so much, Suzanne.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, Bassam. Take care.
That was Susan Abdelhawa speaking with Bassam Haddad. This interview originally happened on December 22nd, 2024. We are out of time, But of course, I want to remind you that it takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Many, many thanks to Mohammed Al-Ghul and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Stan Robinson and Steve Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week. Thank you.